Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the relationship between photography and reality? The idea that a photograph can capture a moment exactly as it occurs has made it a vital tool for documenting real life since the earliest days of the medium. But do we give too much credence to what we see in pictures and what they seem to prove? And how do the choices of those behind the camera influence the impression viewers take away? Author and documentarian Errol Morris explores these questions in his new book, Believing is Seeing, Observations on the Mysteries of Photography. Errol, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Your fascination with the truth or the fiction of photographs began when you were a child, looking for clues to the story of your father's life. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Photographs, probably since I've been a very little boy, have been mysterious. I lost my father when I was 2 years old, and I feel I should know him. His photographs were certainly part of the world that I grew up in. And yet I don't really know him. Here's a face that is so familiar to me, but who exactly was he? And I have to confess, I don't really know. He remains a mystery to me.
And I guess the idea was that the photographs would somehow tell you more than talking to your brother who had memories of your dad or your mother?
Well, of course, photographs for many, many people recall moments from their past. And there are all kinds of associations that we carry around with us about people and certainly also about photographs of people. But I have no real memories of my father at all. What I do have is the various stories that people have told me and the photographs that were taken of him during his life.
So as an adult, you do believe it is possible to know the absolute truth about certain things. You're not necessarily convinced that photographs are as good as proof when we're looking for that truth.
I would put it slightly differently. Mm-hmm. Photographs make us think we know more than what we know. They give us a false sense of security. When I look at a photograph, I have all kinds of beliefs about a photograph, what I'm looking at. But there's something else that I know about photographs that really fascinates me, and it's at the heart of this new book, Believing and Seeing, is that connection that a photograph has with reality, with the real world. You can't just read it off of the surface of the photograph, but you can investigate. I sometimes think of it as a route into history. So, for example, I have a pair of photographs that were taken during the Crimean War. They were taken outside of Sebastopol in 1855. And what I think about them, I think of them as a wormhole, a kind of way to enter the past. Not through some overall narrative, but through some very specific event. You know, if you read a normal story about the Crimean War, they would start with all the historical antecedents, and this happened, and then that happened. Well, here, it's a very different kind of story. And as I would argue, a mystery. We look at these photographs, and then imagine yourself walking maybe through a pinhole into the past, to that moment when the photograph was taken, and looking around and trying to figure out what happened. Not overall the narrative of what happened. What happened at this specific moment in time, at this specific place, when the photograph was taken?
And when with this pair of photographs taken by Roger Fenton in the Crimean War, for a century and a half, people have argued over which one came first, because one of them, they both are taken with the camera in precisely the same place, but one of them shows the road sort of scattered with cannonballs, and the other one shows all those cannonballs over to the side of the road.
Yes, they claimed that the photograph was posed, that Fenton put the cannonballs on the road for various reasons. Various kinds of stories were constructed. He wanted to make the area where he was taking the photograph look more dangerous than it really was. He wanted to create a more graphic image. He wanted to show that horrors of the terrors of war. So I looked at it as the start of an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
What really was Fenton showing in these two photographs? And yes, that additional question, which came first?
Of course, knowing which came first, and we'll leave, I guess, the solution to this question for people to read in the book. But
yeah, they got to buy the book.
We have to have you make money so you can keep making works of art and documentary and writing books. But knowing which came first I think the false assumption is that allows you to know which one was staged and which one wasn't, because in fact they could both have been manipulated.
Yes, it seems, and of course it really is, a fussy kind of question, but behind the fussy question, behind my, I suppose I should be clinically diagnosed in some way, but behind my obsessiveness and my compulsions, I actually believe looking at these photographs, looking at any photograph, very, very closely and thinking about it and investigating it has a lot to teach us about the nature of how we see things, about photography in general, about evidence, about our attempts to find truth or to uncover the way the world really is as opposed to the way we hope it is or how we would like it to be or how it seems. So I think there's something deeper and more interesting in the enterprise than just, say, going on and on about which came first or whether it was posed. But yes, that's certainly part of the deal.
Well, when you talk about, you know, a pinhole into the past or into this place, I have to imagine that you wish that somehow you had the power to turn around 180 degrees and see what was taking place. There's always the enduring question of what is left out of a photograph, and there are a variety of reasons for doing this. But can you talk a little bit about, you know, the choices that, you know, people frame things into or out of a picture?
Well, of course, I at least among the various trades I am engaged in, one is filmmaker. That's one of the hats I wear. And as a person who photographs stuff all the time, I'm always aware of how much I exclude. You're editing a documentary. People invariably ask, well, how much did you shoot?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the movie's an hour and a half or 2 hours long. How much did you shoot? How much got discarded? And I never liked the question because it seems in some way irrelevant the question, well, did you like the movie? But it is an interesting question. Okay, I'll confess. And the answer is that I shoot an enormous amount. I'm always acutely aware of how much gets discarded, almost everything. And that's true of a film, and certainly it's true of any still photograph that's taken. all those things that remain unseen, hanging around the edges. You talked about the desire to turn 180 degrees. Absolutely. How about just turning 10 degrees or 15? All of those things that are in the world of that photograph or the world in which the photograph was taken that are unseen. I even imagine in the Fenton photograph an elephant standing just outside of frame.
We have no proof that it wasn't there.
Certainly not in the photograph itself. And my question is, isn't there always a photograph, an elephant standing just outside the frame of a photograph?
You know, it's interesting, Errol, because on this show we do occasionally speak with still photographers, and we've talked to some who shoot the natural world in particular, and they're trying to document it as it is and show us something about wildlife. And there are two sort of schools of thought. Some of these folks will deliberately frame out or edit out, say, telephone poles and passing airplanes, because that doesn't seem to fit with our vision of what nature really is. And some will leave them in, saying this is the reality of the existence of this wildlife. And I'm not quite sure what these choices mean with regard to the honesty of their work or the manipulation of their work. Can you talk a little bit about your take on that?
Well, there's an element of choice. I have my crazy definition of art. People should never, ever, under any circumstances, give you their definition of art, but I'll give it to you anyway. Here's my definition. You set up a set of arbitrary rules, and then you follow them slavishly. So that anybody who, and I certainly would love to be thought of as an artist, I like to consider myself as an artist. But you're making choices about things that you show and that you don't show, and you're making choices about how you show things. It's part of the deal. And people who pretend otherwise, people who claim, this should always raise suspicion. People who claim that they're serving you the truth or they're serving you reality, the unadulterated truth or unadulterated reality on some kind of silver platter, usually are misrepresenting something, and probably a whole lot of different things.
Is it a laudable goal, though, even if it's impossible?
Sorry, a notable...
Is it a laudable goal?
A laudable goal.
I'm talking about documentary work here, not speaking, art photography
speaking,
specifically.
Seeking the truth maybe is the laudable goal.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no way, there's no proper way to seek the truth. It's not like you open up a guidebook to the truth and they give you 10 ways, like the scientific method or some such thing. You follow these rules religiously and truth will pop out like out of a meat grinder. And it doesn't work that way. Alas, it would be nice if it worked that way. The best you can do in a film, and I've tried my level-headed best to do this, is to make an audience think about the question of what is true and what is false.
Author and filmmaker Errol Morris is my guest. His new book is called Believing is Seeing, Observations on the Mysteries of Photography. His most recent documentary film is called Tabloid. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in now. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and filmmaker Errol Morris. His new book is called Believing is Seeing, Observations on the Mysteries of Photography. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about photographs that suggest something that may not have happened. Another thing you treat in the book is this famous photograph by AP photographer Ben Curtis, who captured a picture of a Mickey Mouse doll lying in the rubble of this bombed-out building in Lebanon after an Israeli attack in 2006. We see that single picture, and we instantly assume we know what happened before it was taken.
Yep. There are lots of photographs where you look at them and you say to yourself, well, it's obvious what that's about. And of course, my view is that there's nothing so obvious that it's obvious. Maybe it's I like investigating stuff.
You have a background as a private investigator, right, before you became a filmmaker?
Well, I started making films, and then I was an out-of-work filmmaker, moonlighting as a private detective, yes.
Same set of skills?
Sorry?
Is it the same set of skills often?
Surprisingly, yes. Hmm. Yeah. Because what is investigating? It's digging around in files. It's talking to people. Yes. It's... If it isn't the same set of skills, it's very, very, very similar.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have David on the line in San Francisco, California. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Let's see, it's an afternoon for you. It's still morning for us. And that's something that no photograph could prove. But, you know, I wanted to raise the idea of photographs as evidence. Whether or not they can be used or misused as evidence. And I gave your screener the example of the Rodney King footage. If people remember back to those days, the photograph starts off as a very wide shot. And if I remember right, there's a shot of a helicopter, and the helicopter has got a bright beam that's shining down on a car. And surrounding that car is something like 17 police officers. And then the camera zooms in, and the shots then are of the cops beating and beating and beating Rodney King. So when that evidence was submitted to the courts, the police made certain that the opening frames showing the helicopter and the bright light and the 17 other police officers just lounging around watching as Rodney King is beaten by four officers, that the earliest frames were denied the court. So so Rodney King was never able to use those first frames, and they just played that same beating footage over and over and over and over and talked about how scared those poor cops were about Rodney King jumping up off out of the ground and beating them, when in fact there were as many as 22 officers, including the ones in the helicopter on the scene, so wouldn't have had a chance.
What about that, Errol, where we think we have the whole story thanks to a photograph, but in fact, or a video, but of course we don't?
Going back to the very beginning of the question, are photographs evidence? And my answer would be absolutely. The question remains, however, evidence of what? Hmm. We know that, you know, in most instances, a photograph is a photograph of something. But to figure out exactly what we're looking at usually takes something more than just simply looking at it. It means investigating. Every photograph, in some real sense, has been decontextualized. It's been ripped out of reality. You don't see to the left and to the right. You don't often see before and after. And even a video, like the Rodney King video, it starts at a certain point. What happened before? What happened after? And as you have just pointed out, often even the video itself has been edited to omit various elements of one kind or another. But even an observation that you made, which is, of course, incredibly interesting, how would we know that there was more to the video than what was presented to the court? We have to really try to look for it.
You know, we talk a lot, Errol, about the ethical obligations of people who are shooting photographs and videos and film for the purposes of presenting it as factual events. What obligations do we have as the viewers and the consumers of these images?
I'm not sure I would describe it as an obligation, but my book, Believing in Seeing, is an attempt to say to people, don't uncritically accept the images that people put before you. We need to ask questions about them. We need to know more. Now, admittedly, how can you do that in every instance? The answer is you can't. But you can be aware of the fact that photographs can mislead us in so many different ways.
There's also the reality that at times a photograph tells the truth of a story, even if the image or the scene has been manipulated. Can you tell us a little bit about Arthur Rothstein?
Well, I have a chapter in the book about, well, this legendary group of photographers during the Roosevelt administration. FSA photographers, Dorothea Lange, Arthur Rothstein, Walker Evans. Arthur Rothstein became embroiled in this huge controversy involving a cow skull that was photographed during the Dust Bowl. And people claimed he had moved the skull about, actually had brought the skull there. It became a big deal in the newspapers. One of the ironies of the story, it kind of amuses me, is people claim that he had committed this fraud, making people think that there was this terrible drought in the Dakotas, and in fact, there was. So if anything, the photograph was telling, or at least telegraphing, some underlying reality. But still, the issue of posing and the manipulation of the image became controversial, became a cause célèbre in its own right. What can we learn from that kind of thing? I don't think there are any sets of rules. When I first started out as a documentary filmmaker, you would get these lectures. Well, you're supposed to use available light. You're not supposed to move anything. Don't you dare touch anything. Mm-hmm. That's a no-no. You don't light stuff. You don't... you try to be the fly on the wall. You try to be as inobtrusive as possible and record the world the way it really is. Well, there is no such thing as photographing things the way they really are. Just the mere act of creating a film, editing a film, framing images in a film, lighting a film, and so on and so forth, change the world. You're creating images of the world, but you're not simply recording the world. And that's also important to remember. Having said all of that, I made this movie, The Thin Blue Line, in which I...
The Dallas Case.
Mm-hmm. ...uncovered this terrible miscarriage of justice, a man who had been sentenced to death for a crime he didn't commit. Behind that movie, regardless of how I shot it, whether there was reenactments, music, et cetera, behind that was the impulse to find the truth. That stood behind all of the apparatus of filmmaking, of how the story was told, the editing. My desire to try to resolve a mystery, to understand what really happened, that who had pulled the trigger, who was guilty, who was innocent. And that's what we can ask of all of our journalists and ourselves, is the desire to really try to understand the world to the best of our abilities. But there's no formula that's going to guarantee that you just get that without a struggle.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hey there. Thinking about what you guys are talking about and the upcoming 10-year anniversary of September 11th, you know, I know that there are a lot of photographs and pieces of video that have really been instrumental in kind of spurning and fostering a lot of the conspiracy theories about, you know, who was behind what happened, what happened, et cetera. So just wanted to know if the guest had any insider experiences with that particular event and the photographs and video footage that were a part of it. Thanks.
Thanks for your call. Mm-hmm.
Well, there is no major historical event that has been recorded on film and on video that does not become the center of some kind of controversy. And usually part of that controversy is the allegations that some kind of conspiracy is involved. I have a confession. I usually don't really like conspiracy theories, just because my knowledge of people tells me that people are so unbelievably confused and act so often at cross purposes with each other, that the idea that anybody ever effectively conspires to do anything seems to me far-fetched. Another perfectly good example is the Zapruder film,
sure,
where people have scoured the film claiming that it has been re-edited or re-photographed or manipulated, or they interpret it in such a way to conclude that some kind of great conspiracy occurred. I'm not saying whether there was one or there wasn't one, but being able to determine that from film footage alone seems to me highly unlikely.
It's interesting, though, that the accidental films that Tim mentioned from 9/11 and the Zapruder film, which was in some ways an accidental film because Abraham Zapruder did not set out to capture
absolutely
this terrible crime.
Absolutely an accidental film, yes.
Right. But we somehow give those more credence. We believe that they might have more valid evidence in them somehow because they were not taken with the purpose of, ironically, of revealing anything in particular.
Yes and no. You could say that the fact this was a home movie, that Zapruder was there and just happened to record these events, means that the film is inherently more reliable. But if that's the case, it's certainly become mired in the most amazing controversies over the last 50 years, close now to 50 years.
We have an email here from David who writes, I edit photos with Photoshop. I can manipulate a photo to such a degree, such as removing every person from a picture, that I am now very distrustful of photos that appear in newspapers or on the internet. It's far too easy to bend reality with a photograph. What do you think about that?
Well, hear, hear. Except we really didn't need Photoshop to tell us this. Certainly Photoshop helps, and it certainly provides an unending series of examples, but no sooner did photography come into existence, you know, in the first part of the 19th century, that people were manipulating photographs.
Mm-hmm.
There were photographs, and then probably seconds later, people were manipulating them in order to give various different kinds of impressions, many of them false impressions.
Like those little girls with the fairies that were believed for quite a long time.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
One example among many.
So you think the technology is a red herring?
I don't think it's a red herring. It makes it easier than ever, but it's been part of photography from day one.
Do you think that photographs that are absolutely real, but are somehow taken out of context? I mean, here's another thing where we're not suspicious necessarily. and so therefore we allow ourselves to believe things. Talk a little bit about the context that's provided for photographs and for bits of film, and the fact that many times the people who have gathered those images are not the people who are, say, writing up captions or explaining what we're about to see.
Well, often you do have to look at the history of how a photograph finds its way into a newspaper. The person who took the photograph could have had one idea in mind, the people transmitting it another idea altogether. The minute a caption is slapped on a photograph in a newspaper, it changes the entire photograph and the entire meaning of the photograph. Captions can push us around in a thousand different directions, and we're not even aware of that fact. Yes, indeed. The many, 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 many ways that we can come to believe something which is false, and photographs certainly play a role in that.
Another thing you'll see sometimes in a, you know, one of these tabloid television shows about true crime or things like that, and they'll show a photograph of someone in childhood looking very upset, and we don't know, in the photograph they might be crying because they've just dropped an ice cream cone or because they want to take a nap, but we look at those suddenly in context of some later crime that happened, and we make assumptions that may not be valid.
Yeah, I have a line in Believing is Seeing. It's one of my favorite lines, is that photographs track false beliefs like flies are attracted to flypaper.
Hmm.
That's one of the interesting things about photography. On one hand, we are connected to the world. Maybe Photoshop makes that seem less evident than it might have been before, and often less clear than it might have been before. But we have this feeling that it's a photograph taken of something. We look at a photograph of Abraham Lincoln, and the presumption is Lincoln was in front of the lens of that camera, and his image was recorded on this photographic plate. So on one hand, you have this really strong causal connection.
You know, I'm going to jump
real
in here.
World, and on the other hand,
we have to take a quick break, Errol. I'm going to jump in right here because we have to go away in 10 seconds. Errol Morris is with us. His new book is called Believing is Seeing. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and filmmaker Errol Morris. His most recent documentary is called Tabloid. We're talking this hour about his new book, Believing is Seeing, Observations on the Mysteries of Photography. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Errol, I'm sorry we had to interrupt your train of thought earlier because of the clock, but in talking about false beliefs being attached to photographs, you mentioned a photo of Lincoln, for example.
Yes. We can always imagine so many different things about photographs. We have beliefs about what we're seeing. Often we fail to investigate the actual connection of that photograph to the real world. And that's part of the mystery stories in Believing and Seeing, is trying to re-examine that connection, to try to look back into history and try to once again ask the question, okay, I'm looking at a photograph, but what really am I looking at? What is this a photograph of?
I'm interested in something you did in the book, which was in certain spots you would reproduce conversations you had with people who were experts on the works of photography that you were examining. And as you reproduced these sections of conversation, you would not sort of put an ellipsis where you would pause within the conversation and say, hang on, I have to help my dog get up on a chair. You left those in there. Was that about being wholly truthful about that section of the conversation? Because clearly you didn't reproduce the entire conversation. Talk about your thinking there and how that relates to the story, to the sort of thesis of the book itself.
Well, I liked the idea that I would include things that normally other people would leave out. I like trying to give a feeling for the process of investigating stuff. Often we see the results of an investigation, but we never really see someone actually Sherlock Holmes-like going through those various steps of trying to figure out something. And I hope that this book has a little bit of that in it. So, yes, references to my beloved French bulldog, Jackpot, and many other things I think are really an important part of the story.
Do you always have multiple irons in the fire?
I seem to work best that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why, but yes, I do.
And so does one project really influence another, or are they discrete in your mind?
I think it's all the same project. I think that everything that I'm working on relates to everything else. They dovetail at the very least. So I don't think they are separate, and that makes it a little bit easier. I'm surprised all of a sudden I never thought that I would write a book. I had writer's block for many, 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 many years, and it's still a little, I guess, amazing to see this thing. I actually wrote this thing, and I think I'm going to write another one.
I want to talk just for a few minutes about the new film Tabloid, which I think was released a couple of months ago, and we were able to watch a copy of it here. This is the story of Joyce McKinney. People who listen to this show may remember that we did a show on dog cloning a few months ago, and so she came up there as a subject. You were focusing on what made her infamous, particularly in Great Britain in the late 1970s. Can you just give us the one-minute version of the film, and then we can talk a little bit more about it?
Well, it was inspired by an AP story that I read in the Boston Globe, a story about a 30-year-old sex and chain story about a woman who was accused of raping a man and who ended up in prison outside of London. But connected to that story was a woman. Recent dog cloning story. So it was a combination of both of those that made me actually want to make a movie.
And so Joyce McKinney was this woman who was accused and, in fact, served some time in prison for this crime. Were you surprised that, at least when we see her on screen, she seems to be more than happy to share her story with you?
Oh, yeah, she was very much a willing participant. You don't give a performance like that unwillingly. She was one of the more amazing interviews that I've ever had.
Because she was so, I don't know if candid is the right word, willing?
I think a combination of things. She's just an unbelievable storyteller. Just the level of energy, the combination of wild emotion, the crazy details of a story which is, you know, of itself kind of hard to believe. All of the above.
How important is it to you that the audience comes to the same conclusion that you do with regard to the veracity of the stories your subjects tell you?
Well, I'm not sure what conclusions I came to in this case. Let's say if the Sinbu line, is it important to me that people believe, as I did, that this central character, Randall Adams, was innocent of the crime he had been convicted of? It was essential.
Mm-hmm.
I was, in many ways, creating a brief for why there had been a terrible miscarriage of justice. This is a very different kind of story because here the truth is elusive. There are certain things about this story that I may never know, nobody may ever know. And the characters all have Rashomon-like different versions of what transpired. Truth is an admirable and essential goal, but sometimes you can never grab hold of it. Evidence is missing. People have forgotten stuff and selectively remember the past in a way that best suits them. People die and are unavailable to be interviewed. And other people who are available to be interviewed, for example, Joyce's ex-boyfriend, just won't talk.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Well, you know, it was interesting to read the book and then to watch the documentary, and they are not on the surface related. But, you know, when you just made the statement that no one perhaps will ever know, ordinarily, you know, one might jump in and say no one except the people who were in that room. But having watched the film, you get the sense that maybe even the people who were in that room don't absolutely know the truth or don't have the capacity to understand it today.
I agree completely. There's this idea somehow that we have privileged access to our own minds, that we actually know what really has happened to us or what really hasn't happened to us. And we all live, some of us more than others, in various kinds of dream states where we believe what we want to believe and we deny what we would like to deny, independent of what really happened or independent of what's really the truth. And Tabloid is very much a story about just that sort of thing.
What is your sense of people's disdain for tabloids? Very few people will say, I adore tabloids, and yet a lot of people seem to know about the stories they contain.
Well, it's fun to diss tabloids, but you know, I can tell you I love them. And it's not altogether clear to me, if someone forced me to give a definition of what is a tabloid story, do I really know? But we do know those elements of the lurid, the sensational, is part of the tabloid idea. And tabloid stories are everywhere. They're ubiquitous. They're not just in tabloids. I can find tabloid stories in the New York Times as easily as I can find them in the National Enquirer or the Weekly World News.
Well, there's the Dominique Strauss-Kahn case, for one.
Perfect example. What is DSK, if not the perfect quintessential tabloid story?
And what a reversal of roles and fortunes and victims and everything else. And, of course, we're not quite at the end of this, but It's been, you know, the switchbacks, I guess, as a subject of fascination for human beings, we just can't let that one go.
I once thought of a tabloid story as you read it and you think, well, this could have happened to me. I certainly understand the story and the human impulses behind it, and I'm really glad it didn't happen to me. I'm glad I have nothing whatsoever to do with it.
Seems like most of them also have a clear element of humiliation for someone who's directly involved.
Not always, but often, yes. I think that's true.
Do you feel a sense of responsibility for the subjects of your films in particular if they might come away either feeling personally humiliated themselves or perceived as humiliated by people who watch the films?
Well, this is an issue that certainly has come up in the case of Tabloid. And the answer is yes, I do feel responsible. Having said that, I don't think that my job is really to sanitize a story. My job is really to record a story and to present a story and to make a story interesting. Joyce, when the movie was released, complained that I had interviewed other people other than herself. She was certainly aware that I was doing that from the very beginning. You can't be certain when you make a movie, certainly a movie with real people, that everybody's going to like it in the end. But you can try to tell a story which is rich, complex, interesting, and so that the people in the story emerge as real people. I often think that the job of a documentary filmmaker is to try to capture the complexity of reality. Because reality is complex, and stories are very rarely simple. And the story about Joyce, the dog cloning, the sex and chains 30 years ago is a really complicated story. And I am certain I never really got to the bottom of it. But I tried my best to capture Joyce and some of the people around her and the complexities of the story in Tabloid and the movie that I made. And geez, I think that's the most you can do.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that she had complained that you spoke to other people as well, because I have to say, watching the story, I thought, gosh, this would be humiliating if it were my story. But watching her on screen, I didn't get the sense that she would be bothered by any of it, because she seemed so open in her telling of things. So perhaps she had a greater capacity to feel embarrassed by a telling of this story than I had imagined as a viewer.
Do I understand Joyce? Not really. I find her still a puzzling, enigmatic character. But I do know one thing for sure, is that she was not my victim. She made this movie with me. It is her story, and I would say, you know, I haven't done a pie graph of how much time versus all the other characters she has on screen, but she's the dominant figure by far, and is given an opportunity to tell her story powerfully in her own words.
Is liking someone different from enjoying watching them on screen?
I suppose it is, but a lot of people who see Tabloid really like Joyce. Mm-hmm. As well as enjoy her. And I think that's a great thing. I think it's a good thing.
Can you give us a clue about what the next book's going to be about?
Well, I have two books in the works. A book about the Jeffrey McDonald murder case. It's a 40-year-old murder case involving a Green Beret doctor.
By the way, we're just about out of time, so I hate to rush you, but about 10 seconds.
And another book about Thomas Kuhn, who threw an ashtray at my head at the Institute for Advanced Study 40 years ago.
We will look forward to both of those, and hopefully you'll be back to talk about them. Errol Morris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Errol Morris's new book is called Believing is Seeing, Observations on the Mysteries of Photography. His most recent documentary is called Tabloid. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.